tea leaves at the bottom of their cups. What omens are these? The horses are telling us to drink something stronger than tea. This counsel is invaluable. The siblings dearly wish to be quiet, and it's been their experience that alcohol ties their tongues for them. So they drink that at the kitchen table, facial expressions set to neutral, knees scraping together as each stares at the amply bugged wall behind the other's head. It's a spectral wisp of a film. Film more in the sense of a substance coating your pupils than it is a stream of images that moves before you. It's all felt more than seen. Tension darkens each frame. By the end, you can see neither into these siblings' lives nor out. Neither, it seems, can they. The film seems to be a judgment upon the written word and the stranglehold it assumes. Woe to those who believe in what is written, and woe to those who don't. I put this to Aisha, and she shook her head. It's a puppet show, she said. Yes, it's that too. The film's siblings are played by two feminine-looking puppets and voiced by a singer and a puppeteer, both friends of A's stepfather. The sister towers over the brother. She's wooden. The brother's made of metal, and his face is one of the most arresting I've seen. Composed entirely of jagged scales. Scales for eyelids, a button-shaped scale for a nose. When he opens his mouth to speak, it's as if the sea is speaking. I decided to show the film to my own sister, Odette, and as I waited in the lobby of Hotel Glissando, I used the free Wi-Fi to watch it again in miniature on my phone. A man tapped me on the shoulder, and I looked up. He was a black man about my father's age and half a head shorter than me. Those sideburns, I'd seen them and him before, but couldn't think where. The man was talking. I pulled my earphones out.
"Looking well, Freddy. How have you been?"
"Yeah, really well, thanks. And yourself?" I hadn't a clue who he was, but as long as one of us knew what was going on, I didn't mind chatting. He nudged me with his elbow and winked. "You're surprised to see me, eh? Thought I was dead, didn't you?" When he said that, it all came back to me. This man really was supposed to be dead. He was my godfather, and I'd last seen him at my christening. I might have gone to his funeral, but I'm not sure. I've been to so many, they all blur together.
"Gosh, yes! So you're really alive after all. Excellent!
How did you manage that? I mean, you went
sailing."
"Yes," he supplied, beaming.
"Right, sailing. You were circumnavigating the globe in your boat, and then there was that Cuban hurricane and bits of the boat washing up on various shores."
"I ditched the boat pretty early on, Freddy," my godfather said serenely. "Sailing isn't for me. I only came up with the idea to get away from the wife and kid, really, so once I got to Florida, I just let the boat drift on without me."
"So you let your family think you're dead? Jean-Claude?"
"That's right. I've been living here at the Glissando for years." His hand moved in his pocket. I could guess what he was doing, having seen others perform the same ritual. He was running his finger around and around the outside of his room key card, doing what he should have done before he checked in and became subject to the rules. Before assuming ownership of a key, you should look at it closely. Not only because you may need to identify it later, but because to look at a key is to get an impression of the lock it was made for, and by extension, the entire establishment surrounding the lock. Once you check into Hotel Glissando, there's no checking out again in your lifetime. I imagine this is a taste of what it is to be dead. In many tales, people who've died don't realize it until they try to travel to a place that's new to them and find themselves prevented from arriving. These ghosts can only return to places where they've already been. That's all that's left for them. Depending on the person, that can still be quite a broad existence. But whether its possessor is widely traveled or not, the key card for each room at Hotel Glissando is circular. If you took the key into your hand and really thought about it before signing the residency contract, this shape would inform you that wherever else you go, you must and will always return to your room.
It's nice and quiet here, and every morning there are eggs done just the way I like them, Jean-Claude said.
Jana divorced me in absentia and remarried anyway. She's fine. And just look how well my boy's doing. My godfather opened a celebrity magazine and showed me a 4-page spread of his son's splendid home, Kedeleomeneko's House of Locks. Sumptuous, mysterious. Kedeleomeneko's your son? I waved my phone at Jean-Claude. Did you know he's in this film I'm watching?
The film had ended while we'd been talking. I played it again. Jean-Claude's gaze flicked suspiciously between me and the screen of my phone.
All I see are puppets.
Yes, he's the voice of the brother. I waited until the silvery face was the only one on screen and then turned up the volume. Jean-Claude listened for a moment and then nodded.
What's this film, then?
Oh, it's my girlfriend's. Well, she wrote and directed it. Jean-Claude gripped my arm.
You know my Kedeleoma?
Well, not personally, but why do you want to be, you know, reunited? I hadn't missed my chance after all. Here was a service I could provide to Jean-Claude and his famous son. This would effect my own reunion with my mother, who would acknowledge my existence once more. But Jean-Claude had no wish for a reunion. His accountant advised very strongly against such sentiments. Instead, he wanted me to rescue his son from the clutches of a dangerous character.
Dangerous character? A name, Jean-Claude said darkly, is Taiki Shaw.
Really? You've heard of her?
I tapped my phone screen again.
She's the voice of the sister.
Jean-Claude flipped through another magazine until he found photos of Kedeleoma stepping out hand in hand with a tall, buxom black woman. Her hair was gathered up to bare a neck that tempted me to B-movie vampirism. I wouldn't have guessed she was a puppeteer, and neither would this magazine's caption writer.
Nekor's mystery lady, do you know her? Write in!
Freddy, Jean-Claude said, I've been watching you for a few days now.
Watching me?
From where?
He pointed to a potted palm tree behind the farthest phone booth.
There's a chair behind it. Yes, I've been watching you, and you look well. You do look well, but you also look as if you're lacking direction.
I didn't dispute that.
Would you like a bit of gainful employment, Freddy?
Well, yes.
Good. I'll pay you this.
Jean-Claude wrote a number on the front cover of the topmost magazine. If you break those two up as soon as you can.
The figure was high. I had to ask why he was so invested in the breakup. I made some inquiries, and I found out some things about Taiki Shaw, Jean-Claude said, his eyes turning to saucers for a moment. Don't ask me what they are, but let's just say she's not the sort of person my son should be seeing.
Save him. If not for the money, then at least out of human decency.
I'll gladly do what I can. But have you tried asking the concierge or my mother about this?
Yes, of course, but they say it's only in their remit to handle requests that can be fulfilled on the premises.
I see. Well, don't worry, Jean-Claude. I'll deal with this.
Music to my ears, Freddy. That's the Barrandov way.
I was going to have a lot of money soon, but the prospect didn't excite me. Perhaps I'd get more excited as I went along. Aisha introduced me to Kedeleoma without too much prompting. If anything, she seemed amused that she'd discovered the fanboy in me. Any friend of A's is a friend of mine. Kedeleoma Nekor had been famous for years. He'd grown accustomed to living well and to fetting his playmates. If you said you liked anything of his, he gave it to you, even if that meant taking the item off his own body and putting it on yours. He was deliriously happy, too. That was part of it. He freely admitted that Taiki was his first love,
admitted this to anyone who'd listen. Wherever he was, the delectable, ambrosial Taiki Shaw wasn't far away. They couldn't keep their hands off each other. A blended scent rose from their skins, sulphurous, sticky, sweet. Wasn't he rather old to be falling in love for the first time? And who was she? Since Jean-Claude wouldn't tell me what he'd learned about her, I did some research of my own. She was a puppeteer and very far from a well-known one, though she did associate with the likes of Radha Chowdhury and Gustav Grimaldi. Aisha added in an offhand manner that Taiki also did odd jobs and invocations. Odd jobs? Was Aisha hinting at prostitution? Kedeleoma seemed like a nice person, and so did Taiki. If either one was ill-natured, they hid it very well. But it didn't matter. I was there to end their romance. They were in love, and laughed at everything, and assaulted me with the odor of all the sex I was being denied. I know I said denied, as if I had a right to it. But those two filled my brain with the filthiest helium. I watched their wandering hands, and I watched Aisha's deadly beige, and when I blinked, diverse, divine contortions appeared to me, all wrapped up in satin sheets. The bodies I saw and felt combining were mine, Aisha's, Kedeleoma, Taiki's, even the puppets got a look in. I propositioned Kedeleoma, but the typical half-heartedness of my attempt aside, Jean-Claude's son was immune to my charms. He talked about Aisha and explained that anybody who hurt her wasn't going to find it easy to live with all the injuries he and Aisha's stepdad would inflict upon them. He made these remarks in such dulcet tones that it took me a few minutes to realize he was warning me. After that, I had to let Aisha in on my project, before Mr. Protective told her. Once I told her everything, she looked at me with the most peculiar expression. "So you have a tendency not to want anything more than you already have," she asked. "Yes." "And you think that's a problem?" "Clearly it is. It's a difference that's slowly estranging me from my family." "What if I told you that I know both Ked and Taiki well enough to be fairly sure there's no need for you to break them up?" "I've still got to do it. My word's my bond. I told Jean-Claude." "As for Jean-Claude," Aisha said, stirring her tea with sinister emphasis. "Oh, don't. All right. Forget Jean-Claude for now. Listen, Freddy, you're my guy, and together we can accomplish anything. Here's how you break them up." "Your guy? Accomplish anything? Anything? Your guy?" I said, thinking I was talking to myself, but she heard me and asked if I was okay. "Me? Yeah, I mean, yeah. Always. Sorry I interrupted you, didn't I? Go on." Aisha knew a man who gave relationship-ruining head. She suggested getting together with this man and Taiki one evening, giving them both a lot of wine and letting nature run its course. So we did that. I pretended to find it funny when I discovered that this giver of relationship-ruining head was my flatmate, Pierre. Taiki arrived with Kedeleoma and left with him too. Such a companionable couple, enjoying each other and thus his energy so upbeat, she full of quips and observations, both kept revealing their visionary natures, all these hopes and plans, all a bit exhausting, really. Meanwhile, Pierre drank and drank without getting drunk. He also made meaningful eyes at Aisha. I drank water the whole night, gulped it, actually just trying to cool down. Avoiding inebriation helped me think fast and not write that entire evening off. There, on the kitchen counter, were the glasses Taiki and Kedeleoma had drunk out of and then left on the kitchen counter. I swiped them for the next stage of the project. The results of the DNA test were disappointing. Blood-wise, Taiki and Ked were as unrelated as could be, so I'd have to make some effort. I looked the results over carefully, consulted friends with some knowledge in the field, and went to work falsifying particulars. The end result
only had to look legitimate to two dumbfounded laymen. I stress that this was not about Jean-Claude's tachyphobia, or about money, or even about proving to my mother that as a true Barrandov I was equal to any task. I asked them to meet me in the bar at the Glissando.
"What's this about?"
Kedalaoma asked, and Taiki appeared to very briefly meditate on the two envelopes on the counter before asking me what was in them. My mind ticked over as I stammered the words I prepared. Some words about never really knowing our fathers, how we only think we know them, how our fathers' undisclosed dalliances may well cause the world around us to teem with flesh of our flesh and blood of our blood, correspondences we may only recognize subconsciously. "Exactly what is he saying right now?" Taiki was talking to Ked and looking at me. The voice of reason piped up in my ear, beige through and through. "Freddy's lost his marbles."
"Lost them? What was this about loss?"
"Ah, well, I'd found something I really, really wanted. It was my dearest wish that Taiki and Kedalaoma would believe my lie. If they believed me and shunned each other, then I had won. If they believed me and stayed together, then, well, that was another version also worth watching. Even if it meant I'd lost. I still think I might not have gone as far as I did, if they hadn't arrived coated in that scent that drove me to frenzy."
If a book is locked, there's probably a good reason for that, don't you think? Every time someone comes out of the lift in the building where you work, you wish lift doors were made of glass. That way you'd be able to see who's arriving a little before they actually arrive, and there'd be just enough time to prepare the correct facial expression. Your new colleague steps out of the lift dressed just a tad more casually than is really appropriate for the workplace, and because you weren't ready, you say, "Hi," with altogether too much force. She has a heart-shaped face with subtly rouged cheeks, short, straight, neatly cut hair, and eyes that are long rather than wide. She's black, but not local, this new colleague who wears her boots and jeans and scarf with a bohemian aplomb that causes the others to ask her where she shops. "Oh, you know, thrift stores," she says with a chuckle. George at the desk next to yours says, "Charity shops?" And the newcomer says, "Yeah, thrift stores." Her accent is New York plus some other part of America, somewhere Midwest. And her name's Eva. She's not quite standoffish, not quite, but she doesn't ask any questions that aren't related to her work. Her own answers are brief and don't invite further conversation. In the women's toilets you find a row of your colleagues examining themselves critically in the mirror, and then, one by one, they each apply a touch of rouge. Their makeup usually goes on at the end of the workday, but now your co-workers are demonstrating that Eva's not the only one who can glow. When it's your turn at the mirror, you fiddle with your shirt, sleeves rolled up so you're nonchalantly showing skin. Or is that too marked a change? Eva takes no notice of any of this preening. She works through her lunch break, tapping away at the keyboard with her right hand, holding her sandwich with her left. You eat lunch at your desk, too, just as you have ever since you started working here. And having watched her turn down her fourth invitation to lunch, you say to her, "Just tell people you're a loner. That's what I did anyway." Eva doesn't look away from her computer screen, and for a moment it seems as if she's going to ignore you. But eventually she says, "Oh, I'm not a loner." "Fair enough." You return to your own work, the interpretation of data. You make a few phone calls to chase up some missing paperwork. Your company exists to assist other companies with streamlining their workforce for optimum productivity. The part people like you and Eva play in this is attaching cold, hard monetary value to the efforts of individual employees and passing those figures on to someone higher up the chain so that the person can decide who should be made redundant. Your seniors' evaluations are more nuanced. They often get to go into offices to observe the employees under consideration, and in their final recommendations, they're permitted to allow for some mysterious quality termed potential. You aim to be promoted to a more senior position soon, because ranking people based purely on yearly income fluctuations is starting to get to you. You like a bit more context to the numbers. What happened in employee QM7693-2's life between February and May 4 years ago? Why do the figures fall so drastically? The figures improve again and remain steady to date. But is QM7693-2 really a reliable employee? Whatever calamity befell them, it could recur on a 5-year cycle, making them less of a safe bet than somebody else with moderate but more consistent results. But it's like Susie says, the reason why so many bosses prefer to outsource these evaluations is because context and familiarity cultivate indecision. When Susie gets promoted, she's not going to bother talking about potential. We hold more power than the consultants who go into the office, she says. That sounds accurate to you. The portrait you hammer out at your desk is the one that either affirms or refutes profitability. But your seniors get to stretch their legs more and get asked for their opinion, and that's why you and Susie work so diligently toward promotion. But lately you've been tempted to influence the recommendations that get made. Lately you've chosen someone whose figures tell you they'll almost certainly get sacked, and you've decided to try to save them. Manipulating figures with your heart and your mouth, terrified that the figures will be checked. And they are, but only cursorily. You have a reputation for thoroughness, and besides, it would be hard for your boss to think of a reason why you'd do such a thing for a random string of letters and numbers that could signify anybody at all, probably somebody you'd clash with if you met them. You never find out what happens to the people you assess, so you're all the more puzzled by what you're doing. Why can't you choose some other goal? A goal that at least includes the possibility of knowing whether you reached it or not? Face it, you're a bit of a weirdo. But whenever you feel you've gone too far with your tampering, you think of your grandmother and you press on. Grandma is your dark inspiration. Your mother's mother made it out of a fallen communist state with an unseemly heap of valuables and a strangely blank slate of a memory when it comes to recalling those hair-raising years. But she has such a sharp memory for so many other things. Price changes, for instance. Your grandmother is vehement on the topic of survival and skeptical of all claims that it's possible to choose anything else when the chips are down. The official story is that it was Grandma's dentistry skills that kept her in funds. But her personality makes it seem more likely that she was a backstabber of monumental proportions. You take great pains to keep your suspicions from her, and she seems to get a kick out of that. But how terrible you and your family are going to feel if, having thought of her as actively colluding with one of history's most murderous regimes, some proof emerges that Grandma was an ordinary dentist, just like she said. A dentist subject to the kind of windfall that has been known to materialize for honest, well-regarded folk. In this case, a scared but determined woman who held on to that windfall with both hands. Scared and determined and just a dentist, truly. But she won't talk about any of it. That's the thing. Cannot. You could all understand, or at least have sincere reverence for. But will not? Your grandmother's Catholicism seems rooted in her approval of two saints whose reticence shines through the ages. Saint John of Nepomuk, who was famously executed for his insistence on keeping the secrets of the confessional, and Saint John Ogilvy, who went to his death after refusing to name those of his acquaintance who shared his faith. In lieu of a crucifix, your grandmother wears a locket around her neck, and in that locket is a miniature reproduction of a painting featuring St. John of Nepomuk. Some tall helmeted soldiers, a few horrified bystanders, four angels and a horse. In the painting, the soldiers are pushing St. J. of N. off the Charles Bridge, but St. J. of N. isn't all that bothered. Is looking up as if already hearing future confessions and interceding for his tormentors in advance. Boys will be boys, father, St. John of N's expression seems to say. The lone horse seems to agree. It's the 16th century, and the angels are there to carry St. John of Nepomuk down to sleep on the riverbed, where his halo of 5 stars awaits him. This is a scene your grandmother doesn't often reveal, but sometimes you see her fold a hand around the closed locket, and it looks like she's toying with the idea of tearing it off the chain. Suspect me if that's what you want to do. What's the point of me saying any more than I've said? Is it eloquence that makes you people believe things? You are all morons. These are the declaration your grandmother makes, and then you and your siblings all say, "No, no, Grandma, what are you talking about? What do you mean? Where did you get this idea?" without daring to so much as glance at each other. You were in nursery school when your grandmother unexpectedly singled you out from your siblings and declared you her protégé. At first, all that seemed to mean was that she paid for your education. That was good news for your parents, and for your siblings too, since there was more to go around. And your gratitude is real, but so is your eternal obligation. Having paid most of what's gone into your head during your formative years, there's a sense in which Grandma now owns you. She phones you when entertainment is required, and you have to put on formal wear. Take your fiddle over to her house and play peasant dances for her and her chess club friends. When you displease her, she takes it out on your mother. And the assumption within the family is that if at any point it becomes impossible for Grandma to live on her own, you'll be her live-in companion. Was your education really that great? So, when you think of her, you think that you might as well do what you can while you can still do it. Eva's popularity grows even as her speech becomes ever more monosyllabic. Susie, normally so focused on her work, spends a lot of time trying to get Eva to talk. Kathleen takes up shopping during her lunch break. She tries to keep her purchases concealed, but occasionally you glimpse what she's stashing away in her locker. Expensive-looking replicas of Eva's charity shop chic. The interested singletons give Eva unprompted information about their private lives to see what she does with it, but she just chuckles and doesn't reciprocate. You want to ask her if she's sure she isn't a loner, but you haven't spoken to her since she rejected your advice. Then Eva's office fortunes change. On a Monday morning, Susie runs in breathless from having taken the stairs and says, "Eva, there's someone here to see you. She's coming up in the lift and she's... crying?" Another instance in which glass lift doors would be beneficial, not to Eva, who already seems to know who the visitor is and looks around for somewhere to hide. But glass doors would have come in handy for everybody else in the office, since nobody knows what to do or say or think. When the lift doors open to reveal a woman in tears and a boy of about 5 or so, not yet in tears, but rapidly approaching them. There's that lip wobble. Oh, no. The woman looks quite a lot like Eva might look in a decade's time. Maybe a decade and a half. As soon as this woman sees Eva, she starts saying things like, "Please, please, I'm not even angry. I'm just saying please leave my husband alone. We're a family, can't you see?" Eva backs away, knocking a handbag off her desk as she does so. Various items spill out, but she doesn't have time to gather them up. The woman and child advance until they have her pinned up against the stationary cupboard door. The woman falls to her knees, and the boy stands beside her, his face scrunched up. He's crying so hard he can't see. "You could so easily find someone else, but I can't, not now. Do you think this won't happen to you too one day? Please just stop seeing him. Let him go." Eva waves her hands and speaks. But whatever excuse or explanation she's trying to make can't be heard above the begging. You say that someone should call security, and people say they agree, but nobody does anything. You're seeing a lot of folded arms and pursed lips. Kathleen mutters something about letting the woman have her say. You call security yourself, and the woman and child are led away. You pick Eva's things up from the floor and throw them into her bag. One item is notable. A leather-bound diary with a brass lock on it. A quiet woman with a locked book. Eva's beginning to intrigue you. She returns to her desk and continues working. Everybody else returns to their desks to send each other emails about Eva. At least, that's what you presume is happening. You're not copied into any of those emails, but everybody except you and Eva seems to be receiving a higher volume of messages than normal. You look at Eva from time to time, and the whites of her eyes have turned pink, but she doesn't look back at you or stop working. Fax, fax, photocopy. She answers a few phone calls, and her tone is on the pleasant side of professional. An anti-Eva movement emerges. Its members are no longer fooled by her glamour. Eva's a personification of all that's put on Earth solely to break bonds, scrap commitments, prevent the course of true love from running smooth. You wouldn't call yourself pro-Eva, but bringing a small and distressed child to the office to confront your husband's mistress does strike you as more than a little manipulative. Maybe you're the only person who thinks so. That side of things certainly isn't discussed. Kathleen quickly distances herself from her attempts to imitate Eva. Those who still feel drawn to Eva become indignant when faced with her continued disinterest in making friends. Who does she think she is? Can't she see how nice they are? Yes, she should be grateful that people are still asking her out, you say, and most of the people you say this to nod, pleased that you get where they're coming from, though Susie, Paul, and a couple of the others eye you suspiciously. Susie takes to standing behind you while you're working sometimes. And given your clandestine meddling, this watchful presence puts you on edge. It's best not to mess with Susie. One lunchtime, Eva brings a sandwich over to your desk and you eat together. This is sudden, but after that, you can no longer mock others by talking shit about Eva. She might overhear you and misunderstand. You ask Eva about her diary, and she says she started writing it the year she turned 13. She'd just read The Diary of Anne Frank and was shaken by a voice like that falling silent, and then further shaken by the thought of all the voices who fell silent before we could ever have heard from them. And you know, fuck everyone and everything that takes all these articulations of moodiness and tenderness and cleverness away. Not that I thought that's how I was, Eva says. I was trying to figure out how to be a better friend, though, just like she was. I just thought I should keep a record of that time, like she did. And I wrote it from 13 to 15 like she did. You ask Eva if she felt like something was going to happen to her. Happen to me? You give her an example. I grew up in a city where people fell out of windows a lot, you say. So I used to practice falling out of them myself. But after a few broken bones, I decided it's better just to not stand too close to windows. Eva gives you a piercing look. No, I didn't think anything was going to happen to me. It's all pretty ordinary teen stuff in there. Your city, though, is falling out of windows a euphemism? And when you say fell or even window, are you talking about something else? No, what made you think that? Your whole manner is really indirect. Sorry if that's rude. It's not rude, you say. You've already been told all about your indirectness, mostly by despairing ex-girlfriends. Can I ask one more question about the diary? Eva gives a cautious nod. Why do you still carry it around with you if you stopped writing in it years ago? So I always know where it is, she says. Susie gets restless. Ask Miss Hoity-Toity if she's still seeing her married boyfriend, she says to you. You tell her you won't be doing that. The atmosphere in this office is so stagnant, Susie says, and decides to try and make Miss Hoity-Toity resign. You don't see or hear anyone openly agreeing to help Susie achieve this objective, but then they wouldn't do that in your presence, given that you now eat lunch with Eva every day. So when Eva momentarily turns her back on some food she's just bought and looks round to find the salad knocked over so that her desk is coated with dressing, when Eva's locker key is stolen and she subsequently finds her locker full of condoms, when Eva's sent a legitimate-looking file attachment that crashes her computer for a few hours and nobody else can spare the use of theirs for even a minute, you just look straight at Susie even though you know she isn't acting alone. Susie's power trip has come so far along that she goes around the office snickering with her eyes half closed. Is it the job that's doing this to you all, or do these games get played no matter what the circumstances? A new girl has to be friendly and morally upright. She should open up, just pick someone and open up to them, make her choices relatable. I didn't know he was married, would have been well received, no matter how wooden the delivery of those words. Just give us something to start with, Miss Hoity-Toity. Someone goes through Eva's bag and takes a diary. When Eva discovers this, she stands up at her desk and asks for her diary back. She offers money for it. Whatever you want, she says, I know you guys don't like me, and I don't like you either, but come on. That's 2 years of a life. 2 years of a life. Everyone seems completely mystified by her words. Kathleen advises Eva to maybe check the toilets, and Eva runs off to do just that, comes back empty-handed and grimacing. She keeps working, and the next time she goes to the printer, there's another printout waiting for her on top of her document. Resign and get the diary back. Eva demonstrates her seriousness regarding the diary by submitting her letter of resignation the very same day. She says goodbye to you, but you don't answer. In time, she could have beat Susie and Co., could have forced them to accept that she was just there to work, but she let them win. Over what? Some book. Pathetic. The next day, George finds Eva's diary next to the coffee machine, and when you see his ungloved hands, you notice what you failed to notice the day before. He and everybody except you and Eva wore gloves indoors all day. To avoid leaving fingerprints on the diary, you suppose. Nice. This can only mean that your co-workers have more issues than you do. You volunteer to be the one to give Eva her diary back. The only problem is you don't have her address or her phone number. You never saw her outside of work. HR can't release Eva's contact details. The woman isn't in the phone book and has no online presence. You turn to the diary because you don't see any other option. You try to pick the lock yourself and fail, and your elder sister whispers, "Try Grandma." "Oh, diary locks are easy," your grandmother says reproachfully. What's the point of a protege who can't pick an easy-peasy diary lock? She has the book open in no time. She doesn't ask to read it. She doubts there's anything worthwhile in there. She tells you that the diary looks cheap, that what you thought was leather is actually imitation leather. Cheap or not, the diary has appeal for you. Squares of floral print linen dot the front and back covers, and the pages are feather light. The diarist wrote in violent ink. "Why I don't like to talk anymore," you read, and then avert your eyes and turn to the page that touches the back cover. There's an address there, and there's a good chance this address is current, since it's written on a scrap of paper that's been taped over other scraps of paper with other addresses written on them. You copy the address down onto a different piece of paper and then stare, wondering how it can be that letters and numbers you've written with a black pen have come out violet-colored. Also, while you were looking for pen and paper, the diary has been unfolding. Not growing exactly, but it's sitting upright on your tabletop and seems to fill or absorb the air around it so that the air turns this way and that like pages. In fact, the book is like a hand and you, your living room, and everything in it are pages being turned this way and that. You go toward the book, slowly and reluctantly. If only you could close this book remotely. But the closer you get to the book, the greater the waning of the light in the room, and it becomes more difficult to actually move. In fact, it is like walking through a paper tunnel that is folding you in, and there's chatter all about you. "Speak up, Eva," and, "Eva, you talk so fast, slow down," and, "So you like to talk a lot, huh?" You hear, "You do know what you're saying, don't you?" And, "Excuse me, Missy, isn't there something you ought to be saying right now?" And, "You just say that one more time." You hear, "Shh," and, "So, do any of you guys know what she's talking about?" And, "Okay, but what's that got to do with anything?" And, "Did you hear what she just said?" It's mostly men you're hearing, or at least they sound male, but not all of them. Among the women, Eva can be heard shushing herself. You chant and shout and cuckoo call. You recite verse, whatever's good, whatever comes to mind. This is how you pass through the building of Eva's quietness, and as you make that racket of yours, you get close enough to the book to seize both covers, though you can no longer see them, and slam the book shut. Then you sit on it for a while, laughing hysterically, and after that you slide along the floor with the book beneath you until you find a roll of masking tape and wind it around the closed diary. Close shave, kiddo. Close shave. At the weekend, you go to the address you found in the diary, and a grey-haired, Levantine-looking man answers the door. Eva's lover? First he tells you Eva's out. Then he says, "Hang on. Tell me again who you're looking for." You repeat Eva's name, and he says that Eva doesn't actually live in that house. You ask since when, and he says she never lived there. But when you tell him you've got Eva's diary, he lets you in. "I think I saw her on the roof once." His reluctance to commit to any statement of fact feels vaguely political. You go up onto the rooftop with no clear idea whether Eva will be there or not. She's not. You look out over tiny gardens, big parking lots and satellite dishes. A glacial wind slices at the top of your ears. If you were a character in a film, this would be a good rooftop on which to battle and defeat some urban representative of the forces of darkness. You place the diary on the roof ledge and turn to go, but then you hear someone shout, "Hey! Hey, is that mine?" It's Eva. She's on the neighboring rooftop. She must have emerged when you were taking in the view. The neighboring rooftop has a swing set up on it, two seats side by side, and you watch as Eva launches herself out into the horizon with perfectly pointed toes, falls back, pushes forward again. She doesn't seem to remember you, even though she only left a few days ago. This says as much about you as it does about her. You tell Eva that even though it looks as if her diary has been vigorously thumbed through, you're sure the contents remain secret. "I didn't read it, anyway," you say. The swing creaks as Eva sails up into the night sky, so high it almost seems as if she has no intention of coming back. But she does, and when she does, she says, "So you still think that's why I locked it?"
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this production of What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours, Stories by Helen Oyeyemi. Narrated by Anne-Marie Gideon, Peter Merrick, and Bonnie Turpin. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.